So what if, say, hypothetically, you had the chance to vote on what would become the worst financial meltdown in more than a generation?
I'm very happy to support it, and I keep my fingers crossed for the future.
Somebody uncrossed their fingers. An obscure meeting about an even more obscure rule for investment banks back in 2004 might have set the stage for the current financial turmoil. When regulators become enablers, there's no drug better than debt. Hitting bottom. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, October 3rd. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Adora.
Today, an exclusive report from the New York Times about a Securities and Exchange Commission meeting years ago that you just referred to that some say did set the stage for today's financial crisis. Also, we've got reaction to last night's vice presidential debate in St. Louis, a wrap-up on U.S. talks with North Korea, and a few thoughts from the blogosphere on who won the debate, if you can say win or lose. Those stories are coming up, but first, a few headlines.
VP candidates Sarah Palin and Joe Biden can breathe a sigh of relief now that their one and only debate is over. Palin played it folksy and stuck to her talking points but made no major missteps. She repeatedly called John McCain and herself mavericks. Biden saved his attacks for McCain, describing him as a straight-ahead successor to President Bush. The administration's revised $700 billion financial plan may go for a vote in the House today. There's still a significant divide. Tennessee Republican Zach Womp says he changed his mind after talking with his constituents.
I know who's pulling the wagon and who's really fighting to pay their bills and feed their kids and to send them to college. And those people are now wanting us to go ahead and vote yes.
But Texas Republican Louie Gohmert says he's a no and he's not budging.
I was a no on the bill on Monday, and I'm still a no on the bill. And I would encourage people to read the bill before they vote again.
A dozen changed votes from Monday could spell the difference.
European stock markets are generally in positive territory. The FTSE and the DAX are up about 1%. In Asia, the markets lost nearly 2% to close at lowest levels in 3 years. Hong Kong's Hang Seng closed down nearly 3%. In a pretty surprising move, at least to many political observers, John McCain is pulling his campaign staff and advertising out of Michigan, in effect conceding the battleground state to Barack Obama and its 17 electoral votes. McCain campaign political director Mike Duhaime says they're moving resources.
The operations will be scaled back, but will still be in place in Michigan. Resources in terms of some staff and other resources will move to Maine.
McCain also canceled a visit to Michigan, scheduled for next week.
On the campaign trail today, Obama's in Abingdon, Pennsylvania. John McCain will be in Pueblo, Colorado. In baseball, it's playoff season. Phillies beat Milwaukee 5-2. Tampa Bay Rays beat the White Sox 6-4. And the Dodgers crushed the Cubs 10-3. Joe Torre is up 2-0 against the Cubs. What surprised you about last night's debate?
I watched the debate. And while Sarah Palin gave a cute performance, very folksy, very homesy, she still never answered a direct question and read from a script.
So was Palin cute or was she informative? Was Biden talkative or was he
cute.
Informative or was he cute? Give us your thoughts. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I say it ain't so, Joe. There you'll go again, pointing backwards again, though. You prefaced your whole comment with the Bush administration. Now, doggone it, let's look ahead and tell Americans what we have to plan to do for them in the future.
The issue is, how different is John McCain's policy going to be than George Bush's? I haven't heard anything yet.
It certainly was a study in contrast last night in St. Louis in the debate between Republican vice presidential nominee Governor Sarah Palin and Democratic vice presidential nominee Senator Joe Biden. Lots of opinions out there. We'd like to hear yours at 8778-MY-TAKE. But right now we're going to go to the Takeaway's political director, Andrea Bernstein, who was there last night in St. Louis and joins us now. Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning.
Before we get to the debate, very interesting news from the McCain campaign yesterday, announcing, or at least being forced to announce, that they are pulling all of their staff and resources out of the state of Michigan, a crucial state, a key battleground state with 17 electoral votes. What's your thought?
Well, each campaign, you know, is looking at the 2004 electoral map. And, of course, if McCain gets all of the states from 2004, he wins, as did President Bush. But each of them is trying to pressure the other. Obama's trying to pressure McCain in Michigan, in Virginia and some other states. And McCain was trying to pressure Obama in Michigan, which was a Kerry state. But the polls have shown him going way south with the economic news. And yesterday it was revealed that his campaign would not be running any more ads or spending more money in Michigan. They say they're going to Maine, where the Electoral College is split but is still a firmly Obama state. Indiana, which has been a Republican state since 1964, and Wisconsin, which is a Kerry state, they're trying to pull over to their side. But this was the huge talk yesterday in the spin room where I was filing, and all of the consultants were coming in and out and talking about what this meant for the McCain campaign. Everybody was spinning it. The McCain campaign said that they were doing just fine. David Axelrod of the Obama campaign said, "I don't understand why they left. They were doing well." This was the talk right up until Sarah Palin walked out onto that red carpet, shook Joe Biden's hand and said, "Can I call you Joe?" And that set the tone for a lot of her comments during the debate, where she really tried to link herself to the problems of the ordinary American.
Let's commit ourselves, just everyday American people, Joe Sixpack, hockey moms across the nation. I think we need to band together and say, never again. Never will we be exploited and taken advantage of again by those who are managing our money and loaning us these dollars. We need to make sure that we demand from the federal government strict oversight of those entities in charge of our investments and our savings.
Well, there were certainly a lot of questions about how Palin was going to perform last night and how Biden was going to respond to her and clearly her very folksy style.
Right. And she probably did herself some good by flubbing some television interviews because the expectations were very low. But she's done a lot of debates as Alaska governor, and she knew exactly what to do. She came out. She stood straight and tall. She looked either at the camera, meaning the viewer, or at Joe Biden. Whereas for a while, he didn't seem to know what to do. He seemed subdued. He was talking a little slowly. He was looking at the audience, which meant he was looking off camera.
You got to figure Tina Fey's pretty bummed out this morning after that performance.
Well, I think with those doggone it, she'll still have a little bit of material in the Hockey Moms and Joe Sixpack. I mean, I think there's some stuff there. But, you know, Biden wasn't having it. I mean, he was pretty disciplined on characteristically for him, and he kept talking about the middle class of America. And in fact, when he started talking about McCain's proposed corporate tax cuts, he squared his shoulders, he looked into the camera, and he engaged. Here it is.
The economic engine of America is the middle class. It's the people listening to this broadcast. When you do well, America does well. Even the wealthy do well. This is not punitive. John wants to add $300 billion in new tax cuts per year for corporate America and the very wealthy.
Joe Biden certainly stuck to what he knows, and that's policy. So did it really end up being policy versus personality? Because Palin, to me, seemed real short on specifics.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think she delivered a level of fluency last night that surprised some people, although it probably shouldn't have. I mean, she's pretty smart, pretty savvy. But she didn't flub anybody's name. She could talk about Iran, Afghanistan, even Darfur. But on the other hand, she didn't give a lot of details. And we were hearing those voters yesterday from Washington, Missouri, saying, well, I want to know what her economic policy is. I want to know what her answers are to the problems that we're facing. And she didn't not get into a lot of specificity with one exception, energy independence, which is clearly a subject that she likes. She wants more drilling, and it's something
that has...
Yeah,
she went back to it twice, and if I recall, she went back to it on a question that Gwen asked her about bankruptcy in the United States.
Right, because for her, it is an economic policy, but she's convincing when she talks about what she knows, what she's done, and links it to what she wants to do. Listen to this.
It's a nonsensical position that we are in when we have domestic supplies of energy all over this great land. And East Coast politicians who don't allow energy-producing states like Alaska to produce these, to tap into them. And instead, we're relying on foreign countries to produce for us.
Go get that oil, Sarah. Save us. Yeah.
Right. Drill, baby, drill.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, the thing is beyond this, she didn't really talk too much about Alaska. And afterwards, I asked Doug Holtz-Aiken, who's McCain's top policy advisor, whether she talked enough about her experience. And he said she probably didn't. She had only 90 minutes. But we do know that the policy of oil drilling is something that Americans who are experiencing the economic downturn in gas prices, for the most part, when they hear that, they want to talk. They want to hear this. They want to hear what she's saying. On the other hand, she had another big job, as we know, which was to say we are not Bush. When she talked policy, she talked about less regulation, less taxes, more energy independence, not a market departure, a market departure perhaps in tone. Here's her argument on that.
There's a time, too, when Americans are going to say enough is enough with your ticket on constantly looking backwards and pointing fingers and doing the blame game. There have been huge blunders in the war. There have been huge blunders throughout this administration, as there are with every administration. But for a ticket that wants to talk about change and looking into the future, there's just too much finger pointing backwards to ever make us believe that that's where you're going.
And so... that's how they're not going to be like the Bush administration. But again, no details.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that was pretty smart of her, you know, given the situation, given that their economic plan doesn't differ in a lot of ways from the Bush administration. I think it was pretty smart of her to sort of talk about bickering, partisanship, looking back, looking forward, because she, you know, that is an argument. I mean, we know, we've heard it from those voters yesterday. They're kind of disgusted. So, you know, that was a good thing to do, probably. It was a pretty smart thing to say, look, Bush has blundered, because that also has a distancing effect. But, you know, afterwards, and, you know, the spin room is really an amazing thing because, you know, it's a media filing center, but everybody's coming in afterwards. Governors, Senator Claire McCaskill was there, all the campaign top strategists, and they have these big signs so that you can see them across the room that say, you know, Axelrod, who is David Axelrod, Obama's top advisor, or, you know, the McCain campaign had Mayor Giuliani and Senator Lieberman. And, you know, so you could find them all. And what the Obama people came out is, and they just hammered this point home of, we didn't hear details, we didn't hear the policy, we didn't hear the prescription for how she's going to get away from Bush. And they also sort of signaled something. They kept talking about the differences between Obama, Biden, and McCain, Palin on health care. McCain wants to get rid of the employer tax credit and make it an individual tax, get rid of the employer deduction and make it an individual tax credit. And they said he's going to be raising taxes. So I think we're going to be seeing a big pushback from the Obama campaign. One of their big vulnerabilities, I know, from being out among voters is on taxes.
One of the ironies here is that Obama and McCain voted for the Bush economic plan this week. So figuring out what the differences are on economic policy is really kind of hard for the voters.
Yeah, I think it's true, except that the economic bailout plan is not the policy. I mean, I think the Obama people can, you know, they're saying we want universal health care. We want a tax cut for the middle class. We don't want tax cuts for the rich and big corporations. ExxonMobil, Joe Biden said several times last night. And so that probably gets them some points. I mean, the McCain people were out there just spinning, you know, what a great debater she was.
Right.
You know, Biden, you know, didn't stand up to her. And I think sort of on purely kind of looking at the camera, being straightforward, having better quips, she may have won. But on the other hand, I still think that there's a hunger for voters for details. I've seen it all year. And
well, they have
the
5 weeks,
still need to be forthcoming.
Exactly. They have 5 weeks. Andrea Bernstein, thanks.
Thank you.
Live
Andrea
from the bubble.
Bernstein, yeah, live from the
spin bubble.
Yeah. Our Takeaway political director reporting from the scene of the vice presidential debate.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hi, this is Fitz from Brooklyn. I thought this was one of the better debates that I've seen in all my years watching.
Last night, the vice presidential candidates got to debate, and today you get to weigh in. Share your thoughts with us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
So for the next few minutes, this is a very important story. And if you're watching the headlines about the financial bailout, one of the questions on Capitol Hill is, will Secretary of the Treasury Henry Paulson get his way on this package? Well, back in April of 2004, when Paulson was chairman of Goldman Sachs, Paulson did get his way when he and other leaders from large banks around the world went to the Securities and Exchange Commission and asked to have rules about risky borrowing changed. They wanted to do a lot more risky borrowing, and what's more, they wanted the SEC to allow them to regulate the risky debt situation themselves. 4 years later, the nation is feeling repercussions from that April meeting at the SEC in an obscure basement in Washington. And we know about the meeting because of extraordinary reporting by the New York Times' Stephen Labaton. It's on the front page of the paper today. We also have audio of that meeting to play for you now. Stephen, thanks for joining us. And what was the meeting set to do, and what did they actually do?
The meeting was set to consider a somewhat obscure and complex regulatory proceeding to decide a couple of things on how to set these rules called the net capital rules.
And the idea was that investment banks are actually restricted in the amount of really risky borrowing they can do, and that there are strict rules for federal oversight. Ironically, these are the regulations that Henry Paulson and others in Washington are actually calling for. They were asking back in April of 2004 as investment bankers to have them relaxed, right?
That's correct.
Well, let's listen to some of the audio from the meeting. As you heard it, it's sort of background phone audio, so listen carefully. But here is the discussion, and you can hear in the discussion of how significant they think this is.
Is there any real, I mean, we've said these are the big guys, and clearly that's true, that they're going to be involved here. But that means if anything goes wrong, it's going to be an awfully big mess. And do we feel secure if there are these drops in capital and other things? We really will have investor protection.
Well, we have very broad discretion here. As we mentioned, we're going to be meeting with these firms on a monthly basis.
Well, that was Annette Nazareth, who's the head of market regulation at the SEC, and Mr. Harvey Goldschmidt, who is a commissioner of the SEC, talking there. You can hear that they think it's significant, and they're talking about regulation that's going to happen on a monthly or daily basis. But it didn't happen that way, right, Stephen?
It didn't happen anywhere close to that. I mean, within a few months, Goldschmidt had left, and Nazareth was still there. But what ended up happening is they hired seven people to monitor about $4 trillion on the whole. This is on monitoring the finances of the parent companies. And they never, even in the last 17, 18 months, have completed a single investigation.
Wow. Now, let's use Bear Stearns as an example. It doesn't exist anymore. But at the time, the relaxation of these rules allowed Bear Stearns to go from where to where in terms of debt?
Well, in terms of the whole entire entity, this is the holding company and everything, they went from borrowing about $25 or $26 for every dollar of investment way up to about $33, $34 on every investment, which in financial institutions is a huge jump.
It's 30 to 1. It's more like a hedge fund than it is an actual investment bank, right?
That's right.
Exactly. All right, let's hear again. Here's the discussion of how they tried to anticipate, you know, watching for trouble signs on the horizon if things began to go awry. Here's market regulation head Nazareth and Commissioner Goldschmidt talking.
We have, you know, hopefully a lot of early warnings and the ability to constrict activity that we think is problematic.
This is going to be much more complicated compliance, inspection, understanding of risk than we've ever had to do. Mike, I trust you no end, but I take it you think we can do this.
Oh, that laughter is really chilling. Now, who are they talking about doing this, in quotes?
They're talking about the watching all five of the investment banks that have now either disappeared or had to significantly transform themselves to survive.
Now, all of the banks experienced problems, and we're, you know, reading it in the headlines every single day, but they had information at that meeting that you report on in your piece that indicates not only was it challenging to regulate these banks at this level of indebtedness, but it was mathematically impossible based on their models. Explain.
This is the one part of the reporting that I found, one of the parts of the reporting that I found so fascinating. You had the investment banks all clamoring to have these changes done, and then one loan guy out in Indiana, a computer software expert who writes the software for these companies to comply with all these rules, writes in a letter saying, if you do this, it's going to be a colossal blunder because the companies just can't value their securities on their computer models in any way that will anticipate significant market drops. And the chilling part of the story is the guy, his name is Leonard Bull, never heard from anybody in Washington.
Wow. Now, here's how they discuss, and we don't know the speaker's name here. Here's how they discuss the regulation scheme that they're going to put in place, a self-regulation scheme.
So we're going to depend on the firms, obviously the front line. They're going to have to develop their entire risk framework. We'll be reading that first, and they'll have to explain that to us in a way that it makes sense. And then we'll do the examinations of that process in addition to approving their models and their risk control systems. So, I mean, but it's a large undertaking. I'm not going to try to do it alone.
No,
there's certainly a lot of laughter.
Yeah, chilling laughter. And again, there wasn't a lot of regulation. This goes to Christopher Cox, the head of the SEC. Explain how maybe the buck stops with him here.
Well, he's trying to assert that the program was flawed from the beginning because it was voluntary. But if you look closely at what happened over the last two or three years, he came in 2005, and you take a look at the Inspector General's reports from last week and all of that, it's very clear that in the last two or three years, this was a very low priority for him.
Wow.
The office wasn't adequately staffed. It didn't even have a director for the last year and a half.
And now we're looking at $700 billion. Many of the investment banks don't even exist anymore. Stephen Leviton, incredible reporting. A meeting in April of 2004, which may have been absolutely crucial in this entire financial debacle. We're going to go out on the words of Commissioner Roel Campos, who, as he voted for it, had this to say.
I'm very happy to support it, and I keep my fingers crossed for the future.
Stephen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, John.
Stephen Leviton's exclusive piece is on the front page of the New York Times today.
You know what was so disturbing to me about some of those? Lots of words like hopeful, fingers crossing, and lots of laughter about something they didn't seem so sure about.
$700 billion Hail Mary play. So let's talk about something happier. The vice presidential debate, for instance. What surprised you about the debate? For some, it was this word.
No, doggone it.
Estelle from Boston had this to say.
What ever makes people think that Sarah Palin talks like the common people? Nobody has said, doggone it, I'd say in the last 30 years. Doggone it is not the way people talk anymore in this country.
Well, not on the Boston Commons anyway. So what surprised you? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, this is Jim from Westchester. Listen, we have just suffered arguably the ugliest 8 years under a president who is very fond of calling himself Joe Sixpack. The last thing this country needs is Jane Sixpack in office.
Debates are supposed to be about persuasion. Did the debate last night convince you? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Now we're going to get some headlines from Richard Hake, who's in for Femi Okeh today. Richard?
And Adora, good morning. New figures from Washington out. The payrolls dropped by 159,000 in September. Jobless rate holds steady at 6.1%. Also a story this morning, Wells Fargo buying up Wachovia for more than $15 billion in stock. This ends talks with Citigroup, which bid $2 billion for part of Wachovia. That deal included FDIC help. The Wells Fargo deal doesn't have any government involvement. West Virginia could end up suing investment firms at the center of the national financial crisis and perhaps some of their former executives. The governor there has asked his staff to research possible legal action to recoup losses to the state's multi-billion dollar investment portfolio. It included assets in Merrill Lynch, Lehman Brothers, and AIG. West Virginia investments have lost nearly $23 million at the end of August. A spokesman says Iraq's presidential council has agreed on a law that paves the way for U.S.-backed provincial elections to be held by the end of January. The move ends months of deadlock. Iraqi lawmakers set aside the divisive issues of the oil-rich region around Kirkuk. And in sports, in baseball's playoff season, the Phillies gained a two-game advantage over Milwaukee. The Tampa Bay Rays opened their series with the White Sox by taking the first game 6-4, and the Dodgers crushed the Cubs 10-3 to take a commanding two-game lead heading back to Los Angeles.
Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much. Today marks a very important anniversary in Mexico. In fact, an anniversary that seems to be becoming more important over the years. 40 years ago this week, on the eve of the Summer Olympics in Mexico City, dozens, perhaps hundreds of student protesters were shot and killed by government troops. It was and remains a little covered event by the press, while today calls have grown larger for a widespread investigation into who ordered the shooting. On October 2, 1968, Bob Trevor was a sports writer there covering the Olympics for the London Evening News. Welcome.
Good morning, Adara.
So describe what happened when you went to check out the students and their protests.
Well, first of all, I was working for the London Evening News. And secondly, I went to the Square of the Three Cultures because I'd heard that there was a rally there, mainly of students and of young trade union activists. The square was absolutely jam-packed with people, more than 3,000, I would think. And we were all standing there listening to speeches. And then after about 20 minutes...
What were they talking about? What were they hoping to accomplish that night?
They were talking basically about calling for the resignation of the president of Mexico, Díaz Ordaz, and they were calling for the country to be governed by its constitution.
And so you said about 20 minutes into the event, what happened?
Well, first of all, there were isolated gunshots from top of the buildings. And people, I couldn't see this where I was standing, but I saw people looking upwards. And within minutes of that, helicopter gunships arrived and opened up with machine gun fire.
My. So pandemonium.
Absolute panic. People were terrified. We tried to get out of the square and race along streets that were leading away from where we'd been standing. And it was a sea of human beings pushing forward. If anybody fell, they would have been trampled underfoot.
Now, there was no official recording of how many died that night. The estimates range anywhere from 30 to 300. From what you observed, what do you think?
Oh, I would say there were more than 300. I saw literally dozens of bodies as I was trying to escape down this road. And the people at the front suddenly halted, and the people at the back were pushing forward, and the people in the middle were being crushed. I managed to stand on a low wall, and I could see that ahead of us there were two ranks of soldiers with rifles, and behind them were armored cars with machine gun emplacements. So they were being shot from the front and the back.
But no one really ever going to know exactly how many people died. Why do you think the story didn't get that much attention even a week before an international event like the Olympics?
Well, I worked for the evening paper with the world's largest circulation, and I had a front page lead story within 6 hours of it happening because of the time difference. But there were very few journalists in the square. I know that four were arrested at gunpoint beforehand and taken into a room where they were blindfolded and made to sit on the floor. So the whole exercise was premeditated, and the government wanted to get as many journalists, particularly foreign journalists, as possible, away from the site so that they couldn't report it.
And so it's never been clear exactly who ordered the shooting. Why do you think now there are calls for an investigation?
Well, I think that it's simmered over the years, and I've had correspondence from both Chile and Uruguay of Mexican students, one of whom gave me a list of 250 people who had gone missing that night. And the guy in Montevideo told me that the death total was in fact nearer 900. Now, of course, I have no means of verifying that, but the people who were there that night have over the years been campaigning to get an examination of why this happened.
And so what do you think is likely to happen now?
Well, I think Amnesty International are now involved and are calling for a government investigation in Mexico City. And if that happens, then, of course, there will be records, military records and also government records, of, nearer the real amounts of people who had died. On the night in question, I went to a press conference at about 11 o'clock at night, given by the chief of police, man called Luis Cueto, who told us categorically that 25 people had died,
right,
including seven policemen. Well, that clearly wasn't true from my own eyes.
So still lots to learn about what happened that day, October 2nd, 1968. Robert Trevor, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Robert Trevor is a former sports writer for the London Evening News. He covered that 1968 Mexico City Olympics.
And there's a movie called Tlatelolco, Mexico 68, named for the massacre, that comes out next year with John Leguizamo.
So it's really gaining attention.
It's a very, very famous event. I'll have to learn how to pronounce it between now and that movie's release.
Have we traded places
Tlatelolco
today?
Mexico, an important massacre.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adoree Doji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. We're going to turn our attention to Seoul, South Korea, where BBC correspondent John Sudworth joins us. U.S. nuclear envoy Christopher Hill has returned to South Korea today after 3 days of talks in the North Korean capital of Pyongyang. John Sudworth, there are a lot of mysteries about what's going on in North Korea at this moment, principal among them, the nuclear program. What have we learned?
Well, little from Christopher Hill's visit. He's just arrived back here in Seoul this afternoon. It's 7:45 here in the evening now. He's been back a few hours. He's briefing his counterparts in the South Korean government on what the content of his discussions while he's been in Pyongyang have been. But no word to the press yet. Big press pack outside that meeting, hoping to get some sight of what he's been talking about. What we do know is that North Korea has threatened to restart its nuclear reactor. And that's, of course, very worrying indeed. And really what's prompted Christopher Hill to accept the invitation to go to Pyongyang for the talks that have taken place over the last couple of days.
And these faltering negotiations have as a backdrop the mystery about the health and even whereabouts of Kim Jong-il, correct?
Well, that's right. Rumors surrounding his health at the moment, intelligence reports, unconfirmed and denied very strongly by North Korea, suggest that the North Korean leader had some kind of a stroke in August, suffered some sort of a collapse. Various speculation about exactly how much or to what extent he may be incapacitated. Some question over whether he is still in control of the country. But as I say, North Korea, very strong denials of that, and absolutely saying he's in full health.
I guess what's so mystifying here is that often this nuclear dialogue is kind of a bait and switch sort of scheme where the nuclear talks are one side and there's some sort of quid pro quo issue that eventually comes up in the talks, and when that's settled, then the nuclear issue seems to go away. In this case, there doesn't seem to be much of a quid pro quo on the table.
Well, that's right. It's these talks have been going, this latest round of talks have been going on now for the best part of 5 years. And I think it's fair to say they've been inching towards some kind of progress. A great deal of optimism, don't forget, a couple of months ago when North Korea destroyed the cooling tower at its reactor site. And everybody really very optimistic that we really might start to see the Yongbyon nuclear reactor fully disabled. But they've run into difficulty again. As you say, this is always a question of give and take. The whole premise of these negotiations was that North Korea was going to be compensated into giving up its nuclear weapons, that it was going to get a substantial delivery of fuel aid, as well as certain diplomatic concessions. And the latest deadlock concerns how quickly those concessions are being delivered. North Korea thinks it should have already been taken off the U.S. list of state sponsors of terror. The U.S. says it wants to see more verification of the steps North Korea has taken so far. And once again, we're in this period of deadlock.
John, very quickly and finally here, what's the South Korean position on all this? Are they worried?
Well, I think, again, that they're used to ups and downs in this process. But I think in general, still some signs of optimism. North Korea is still talking. The U.S. is still talking to North Korea. And don't forget, a few years ago, the Bush administration was even refusing to sit down with the North Koreans. So that gives you some idea of how far we've come.
The talks are still going on. They are faltering. There are threats of restarting its atomic weapons program. But nevertheless, right now, a lot of mysteries in North Korea. John Sudworth, thanks so much for joining us. John Sudworth is a BBC correspondent in Seoul, South Korea.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
So what's your reaction to the debate?
One thing that I haven't heard too many people point out is the fact that Sarah Palin really only answered the moderator's question twice the entire night. And I would just like to say that it's hard to have an exciting debate when one of the opponents in the debate essentially refuses to give specifics or respond to direct questions.
Debates about persuasion. Did anything Biden or Palin say change your mind? My take at thetakeaway.org or 877-8-MY-TAKE. And now headlines from Richard Hick.
And, John, we are about 11 and a half minutes before the top of the hour right now. Payrolls dropped by 159,000 in September. Jobless rate holds steady at 6.1%. Those figures just released from the federal government. In Michigan, John McCain is pulling his ads off the air and his staff out of the state, responding to a recent drop in Michigan's polls. McCain is shifting resources to other swing states, such as Ohio, Florida, and Wisconsin. After a bump in the road, an investigation into Sarah Palin is back on track. Alaska Republicans had tried to block the probe, but a state judge threw out the lawsuit yesterday. Palin is being investigated for her role in firing her sister's ex-husband, an Alaska state trooper. Protesters and police clashed in Mexico City as nearly 30,000 people took to the streets to commemorate the 1968 student protests. 40 years ago, Mexican troops fired on pro-democracy demonstrators and killed hundreds of students. Crews are heading back out to the Sierra Nevada crash site today where debris of Steve Fawcett's plane was found. Madera County Sheriff John Anderson says they also found what looks like human remains.
We did discover near the wreckage what appears to be bones. I'm not a pathologist, but I will give a lay opinion that what was found there was in fact a bone.
And officials say they'll conduct DNA testing on that bone and Fawcett disappeared more than a year ago.
Thanks very much, Richard.
You're welcome.
John, just another new development we're going to talk about now as we live in an internet world.
Yes, I've
right?
noticed.
Which is, yeah. It was just buzzing last night with people swiftly responding. Sounded just like
that. Internet buzz.
Yeah, internet. Thanks for that.
I downloaded it.
Anyhow, the point here is that people all over the country, all over the world, were able to swiftly respond to every single thing that was happening during that vice presidential debate in St. Louis. On Politico.com, they got a real dose of it because they have a page called The Arena, which really pulls together policymakers and people from all walks of life, and they all had thoughts. We turn now to The Arena's moderator, Politico senior editor Fred Barbish. Good morning.
Good morning.
So give us an overview of what people were saying as the debate was happening.
The overview basically can be summed up as she was supposed to implode and she didn't, and we're surprised. That basically is, I think, across the board, across the disciplines on ARENA, which has a very wide assortment and across party lines, that has to be the conclusion. People really expected a meltdown out there tonight based on particularly the recent Katie Couric interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the people on the ARENA panel, which is about 130 of them, the one thing they tend to agree on is that that didn't happen. And while the expectation games are often silly, in this instance it isn't so silly since the
right.
campaign was hemorrhaging in part because of her. And as one of my, as Norm Ornstein says on the ARENA, this could stop the bleeding.
Interestingly, perhaps a testament really to the McCain campaign's ability to set those expectations lowly. But give us an example of some of the thoughts.
They didn't have to set them low this time. Yeah,
Katie Couric helped. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
That, but in addition to, I mean, they kind of fed that thought for the days and hours leading up to the debate.
Indeed.
So give us an example or some examples of what people said, and was it split down, were the comments split down party lines?
The comments were actually split down party lines to the extent that people ultimately concluded that Biden was the better candidate. But in fact, there really was no split on party lines on the question of Sarah Palin's performance. Everybody thought it was much, much better than anyone expected. And as I say, I think that's quite meaningful in this situation. Let me read you. We have a corporate executive. In addition to politicians, we have executives and scholars on our panel. And there's a fellow named Steve Steckler who I thought summed it up very well when he said it's not merely that Palin did not mess up, but she reestablished the smart mom persona that was so shockingly effective in giving McCain a near double-digit bounce from the Republican convention. And then he goes out to point out something very important. Trust me, he says, the swing voters out there were not taking notes. They were watching, feeling, and interpreting within the context of the people they know. Biden got the words right, but anyone who walks smugly away from the TV tonight, concluding that he showed the little lady what a real VP looks like, have spent too much time talking politics at Starbucks and not enough at Denny's and Cracker Barrel.
Well, that's certainly an interesting perspective, but there were some questions about how Biden would perform last night, too, and whether he would go on in his very verbose manner and be condescending
and
put his foot in his mouth, and that didn't happen either.
That didn't happen, but that turns out to be less, that left less of an impression than the Palin performance.
You know, the last blog that you read there kind of begs the question of, you know, what goes on in the ARENA here? What is the role of this debate, do you think? I mean, years ago, we just watched the debate and wait for some pundit to deliver a verdict, and you decide, do you agree with it? Do you not agree with it? This is happening during the debate and actually precedes the sort of national consensus about what the debate is. What are you seeing?
You mean what am I seeing in content?
In terms of the role and importance of the consensus.
I think it's changing the way people look at politics and look at events in generally, that grown men and women, not just teenagers and college kids, are sitting, are multitasking, watching TV and sitting on the internet, and their views are being influenced by all kinds of forces that didn't used to exist. Commentators who they read, people who they agree with, who they read in blogs, well-known people that they read in blogs. It's sort of a remarkable. We have a huge number of people sending us, readers sending us their thoughts in the middle of the debate, which I think is extraordinary. And that really has got to change the mix, got to change the chemistry of the of politics in a very strong way that we probably don't even begin to understand yet.
That clearly is a fascinating trend, and John brought up this point earlier, and it's really something interesting to think about, because essentially what we've done now, or what the Internet has done now, is democratize the entire thinking and opinion-building process in a way that hasn't happened before.
That's right. It has democratized it in a way, but as Bill Bishop, one of our panelists, has pointed out in his book, most people tend to go to sites with whom they already agree.
Right, right.
So to that extent, it narrows the focus a little bit that people might have had with a wider view that they would get by watching, right, say, television commentators. The arena exists to broaden that, because we have all parties, we have all kinds of people from all kinds of background, basically smart people from across the board. And the idea there is, in fact, to cross party lines and bring people views from people who don't necessarily agree with them,
right,
naturally.
You know, on the Internet, conspiracy theories are popular. Mine is that these two candidates got together and said, you know what we need is people not talking about these guys anymore, so make it boring, both of you. That's what happened. What was the conspiracy theory quickly on the arena?
The conspiracy theory has to do with her being scripted, really. And conspiracy within the campaign, that basically she's got her memorized lines and she delivered them and you know, better than we thought she would. But that doesn't make her vice presidential. Nobody on here, I have to say, even among the Republicans here, nobody, they may say she won or she lost or she did better than expected. There's nobody here saying she ought to be vice president, not a single person.
So how did she do on the debate? One part of the question, the other part, should she be vice president? Thanks for joining us, Fred. Fred Barbish, senior editor, Politico.com, who moderates The Arena, a daily debate about politics.
They're always on. We're always on at The Takeaway. Election day, less than 5 weeks away. We've got you covered. Complete coverage at our election website, vote2008.thetakeaway.org. And this morning we've been following that vice presidential debate.
What surprised you about the debate, or not?
My name is Pedro from New York City. Doggone it, I learned a new word last night, Bosniaks.
Oh, man, I missed that one. Pedro's references to Joe Biden, who used the word Bosniaks in the debate. What did you learn? 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Here's your takeaway.
The swing voters out there were not taking notes. They were watching, feeling, and interpreting within the context of the people they know.
You just heard him, and that's Politico.com's Fred Barbish.
If you missed any of our Wall Street Rescue Plan coverage, you can catch up on iTunes. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji. It's The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Okay, so this guy is, like, making jokes about 9/11, see?
People looking at me as if I was responsible for 9/11. Can you believe that? Me responsible for 9/11? 7/11, maybe.
Azar Usman says Allah made him funny. Will America take the call?
Yes, hello, Mr. Bush. Ahlan wa sahlan. Kif al-hal ya Georgi?
Laughing off the hook, Muslim stand-up, Ramadan jokes, axis of comedy? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, October 3rd, and we have some comedy today on this Friday, don't we?
Right, that's right. Good morning, Adora.
Today, a preview also of what members of the House are thinking about the Senate's financial bill to help the economy. The House is likely to vote today. Also, a look at the vice presidential debate last night. Did it change any minds? And Muslim comics take a trip around the world, and they made a movie about it. Lastly, reporter notebooks from On the Campaign Trail with Barack Obama and John McCain. A few details you might not know. Those stories are coming up, but first we have headlines.
The Bush administration's revised $700 billion financial plan may go for a vote in the House today. There's still significant divide. Tennessee Republican Zach Womp says he's changed his mind after talking with constituents.
I know who's pulling the wagon and who's really fighting to pay their bills and feed their kids and to send them to college. And those people are now wanting us to go ahead and vote yes.
Who's not budging?
I was a no on the bill on Monday. And I'm still a no on the bill. And I would encourage people to read the bill before they vote again.
That's Texas Republican Louie Gohmert. Both parties need to come up with a dozen or so supporters.
But VP candidates Sarah Palin and Joe Biden, they can breathe a sigh of relief this morning now that their one and only debate is over. Palin played it folksy and stuck to her talking points, but made no major missteps. She repeatedly called John McCain and herself mavericks. Biden saved his attacks for McCain, often describing him as a straight-ahead successor to President Bush. Also in politics, the McCain campaign says it's pulling staff and ads out of Michigan, effectively conceding the state to Barack Obama. Mike Duhaime is the campaign's political director.
The operations will be scaled back, but will still be in place in Michigan. Resources in terms of some staff and other resources will move to Maine.
McCain has canceled a visit to Michigan scheduled for next week. He'll be in Pueblo, Colorado today. Obama's in Pennsylvania.
Wachovia agreed to sell itself to Wells Fargo in a $15.4 billion takeover that will require no government assistance. Top nuclear envoy Christopher Hill has ended a three-day visit to North Korea on nuclear matters. The talks seem to be wavering. In baseball, it's playoff season. The Phillies beat Milwaukee 5-2. The Tampa Bay Rays beat the White Sox 6-4. The Dodgers crushed the Cubs again, 10-3. Payrolls dropped by 159,000 in September. The jobless rate holds steady. Markets are happy about that. The Dow Jones Industrial Average will probably open flat this morning.
That would be good. Oil's down to $93 a barrel, and we want to know what you think of the debate.
Hi, this is Michael. I'm calling from Connecticut, driving into Rhode Island, and I watched the debate last night. I'll tell you, you know, she came across very intelligent. Nothing like the coverage I caught on the television. I'll tell you, it was nice to see that she's doing well. She's just nuts on the head.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
She will project her personality. She will sell her personality. She will not try to out-policy Joe Biden.
He has to be able to say less. She has to be able to know more.
The she is the governor of Alaska, Sarah Palin, and the he, Senator Joe Biden, the two vice presidential candidates who debated last night in St. Louis. The two who were talking are Rita Farrell, a former Reuters correspondent who has covered Biden a long time, and Larry Persilli, a longtime Alaska journalist and a former employee in Palin's Washington office. They join us, both of them join us now. Larry, let's start with you. Lots of questions this week about how Palin would do, and you said there would be a lot of personality. How did she compare last night to the Palin you know?
Well, I think she was more comfortable last night. She tried to cram less into her answers. That was her problem with Katie Kirk. She tried to repeat everything she had tried to memorize during her briefings. It was the folksy, smiling, enthusiastic Palin. She talked about darn right and hockey mom and Joe Sixpack, doggone it, betcha, you bet, shout out to the third graders, dictators hate America. She was comfortable and she avoided getting into details. She went with the campaign attack ads.
Okay, Larry, let's listen to a bit of what she said.
go to a kid's soccer game on Saturday and turn to any parent there on the sideline and ask them, how are you feeling about the economy? And I'll bet you you're going to hear some fear in that parent's voice.
Now, that's the kind of language that got her the governorship in Alaska, right?
Right, and that's the kind of language that excited the masses at the Republican National Convention a month ago.
Larry, although one of our listeners said that actually Americans don't say doggone it, they haven't for the last 20 years. So I learned that this morning.
Well, it depends where you live, right?
Right, exactly. And Rita, you basically said that Joe Biden was going to have to be careful and not talk too much, essentially. How do you think he did?
Oh, he did fine because the format restricted him, and he was very much aware of that and had his answers ready accordingly. So I thought he did very well. I thought he handled himself just carefully and thoughtfully and made his points. What I wanted to see was, while I looked at this debate, I thought, what would it be like under a Biden presidency? What would it be like under a Palin presidency? Because that's what we're really looking at. So he, when his one moment when he broke up, I thought that was interesting because during his entire career, he really didn't mention the talk about the death of his wife and the child way back in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And now he's made that something in this campaign, and that's affected him. So
you're referring to when he was talking about when his first wife died and his daughter died, what it was like to be a single father.
And his annoyance, he was obviously annoyed when Sarah Palin suggested that as a mom raising children, as she would put it, that she understood how people felt. And he said, what about he himself had raised his two boys, made a great effort to be with them by coming home from Washington every single night. And that was a moment when she had her permanent grin on her when she was talking, mm-hmm. and that kind of went off her face when he made his point that as a father, he was there for his children too. So she can't just control that particular area of
the debate. But for the most part, Biden had a lot of details. He clearly showed that he's knowledgeable about the issues. Let's listen to a bit of what he said.
John McCain has voted 20 times against funding alternative energy sources and thinks, I guess, the only answer is drill, drill, drill.
Now, you noted yesterday that this is really his strong suit. He's a very smart man who's very well versed on the issues.
Yes. He is, and he's comfortable speaking. If there had been follow-up questions, that would have made the debate really interesting. This way, it was just performance. But if there had been follow-up questions on anything, he would have been comfortable dealing with them because he has that depth. I don't know about Palin. That seemed to be her weak point when she was being interviewed by Katie Couric, and others. So that would have been a more telling format than just here's a question, then let her go where she wants to go with it and not have to respond with any particular depth of knowledge to repeat what I've said. But he was professional. He was knowledgeable. He was passionate. He was tough. Mm-hmm. She was spunky. She was unflappable. She
right.
stayed on her message, which was allowed as a result of not having follow-up questions. And she was a cheerleader for McCain and for the Republican Party, which is part of her role.
Absolutely. And let's listen to exactly how she did that in talking about the war in Iraq.
Barack Obama voted against funding troops there after promising that he would not do so. And Senator Biden, I respected you when you called him out on that. You said that his vote was political and you said it would cost lives. And Barack Obama at first said he would not do that. He turned around under political pressure and he voted against funding the troops.
You know, Larry, when I looked at Biden, when she would do this throwing it back at him kind of stuff, you did that and I, you know, give you creds for that sort of thing. It seemed like she was really rattling Biden, particularly in the first 20 minutes. Did you notice that, Larry?
Oh, it looked a little bit like he was biting his lip. Though my TV is an old 25-year-old Zenith with a 19-inch screen and the blip wasn't that big, but yeah, I got that impression a little bit. You know, it's her constant smiling and her voice, her sort of digging in. It can be grating, and I'm sure Biden kept telling himself, don't take the bait, don't bite back, don't start a fight, be calm.
But he did, near the very end of the debate, seem to, all of those emotions, or at least some of them, seem to have caught up with him. Let's hear what he said.
Let's talk about the maverick John McCain is. And again, I love him. He's been a maverick on some issues, but he has been no maverick on the things that matter to people's lives. He voted 4 out of 5 times for George Bush's budget, which put us $500 billion in debt this year and over $3 trillion in debt since he's got there. He has not been a maverick in providing health care for people. He has voted against. He voted against including another 3.6 million children in coverage that of the existing health care plan when he voted in the United States Senate. He's not been a maverick when it comes to education. He has not supported tax cuts and significant changes for people being able to send their kids to college. He's not been a maverick on the war. He's not been a maverick on virtually anything that generally affects the things that people really talk about around their kitchen table.
Rita, that was like a dam opening up.
Yes, it was. And this is what happens when he gets into it. As Larry said, he kept himself under control, and he did. He did very well in that. But then this kicks in, this irritation with what he considers nonsense or something that's not forthcoming. And then if they'd had much more time, if they just could go free flow instead of 1.5 minutes and 30-second follow-ups, that would have come to the fore. His anger would have come out because he was very impatient about that.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not hear that in him until the very end, as you point out.
And Larry, there was a lot of pressure on Sarah Palin to deliver a decent performance, if not more than that. And there are many this morning who say that she met that just fine. And so she's really proved that she's capable of the first rule, which is, as a vice presidential candidate, not to do any harm to your presidential candidate.
Right. I guess the expectations were low enough. You're right. She met that first hurdle. She did no damage. But did she prove she could be the president of the United States? Not even close. I mean, there are a couple key questions which she just avoided. She was asked one in particular where it was, what would the president have to drop from his plan that we're hearing about during the campaign? What would he have to drop because of the economic mess the country's in? And she turned it into an anti-oil company speech. She really couldn't answer it.
I just wonder, though, if this debate wasn't completely cast as a contrast of styles, and that people looking at this debate weren't really focused on issues. Maybe they were in the St. Louis Hall there, but in general, people looked to see that Sarah Palin, she's not scary, and Joe Biden, he's not annoying. End of story. We can move on and talk about Barack Obama and John McCain. That's my view.
I think that as soon as the markets open, we find out what happens with Congress and that package, that bailout package, this will be forgotten. But
yeah.
Sometimes it felt like judging the Olympics, you know, degree of difficulty and execution.
I'm the East German judge. I give everybody a 3. Yeah.
Listen, we want to thank you for coming back and joining us this morning.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having
us. Thank you.
Rita Farrell, a former Reuters correspondent who covered Biden a long time, and Larry Persily, a longtime Alaska journalist and a former employee of Sarah Palin.
And we want to get Larry a new TV. That 25-year-old Zenith, I don't think is working for him. Let's see if we can do it. If you want to get Larry Persily a new television, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
What's wrong with his television?
He says he couldn't tell that Biden was biting his lip, that the picture is like too blurry or something like that.
Right. Yeah. I didn't see that either, yeah, though, John. You may be the only one.
Yeah.
No. What do you think
I have
about
all
the debate?
Conspiracy theories. That's me. Yeah.
What did you think of the debate? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or drop us a note, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Peter from Edison. It's an interesting vice presidential debate. She was not the disaster everyone was predicting. He was not the long-winded gaffer everyone was predicting.
Hey, everyone's an Insta pundit. Did you figure that out? How would you change the debate format?
My feeling about the debates is that they should have fewer topics and go into more detail, and that the candidates should be pressed to elaborate on what they would actually do in terms of policy instead of covering all these various topics and so many sound bites.
I go along with that.
Yeah, me too.
877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. So in Congress today, as they're getting ready to vote, how does it feel?
Is the secretary calling? Is the president calling? Is Boehner calling? Yeah, of course.
Lobbying, lobbying, lobbying. Congressman Steve LaTourette talking about being lobbied by John Boehner, the president, by Henry Paulson, to vote on the bailout bill. Who's going to change their vote? That's the drama on Capitol Hill today. New York Times reporter David Herzenhorn has been covering this for a week for us. He's got the pulse from Capitol Hill. David, there are people whose votes have to change for this to pass, so Democrats and Republicans, right?
There are, and that's what we expect, that there'll be some in each party who switch from no votes to yes when this bill is back on the floor this morning. And really, there were two key things that happened. One is they added to the bill an increase in the amount of money in your local bank that's insured by the federal government, by the FDIC, to $250,000 from $100,000. That's given a bunch of lawmakers who say there was not enough help in the broad bailout plan for sort of average folks, and a reason to say, okay, this at least is targeted more toward Main Street. And then the bigger issue is a huge package of appealing tax provisions for lots of stuff, the production and use of renewable energy, but also disaster relief and aid for rural schools.
There's even like an excise tax relaxation for makers of wooden arrows for kid bow and arrow.
There is, and one
really glad that got done.
One Republican congressional aide was saying the problem there was that the tax is actually more than the arrows cost themselves. But but what people should understand is none of these things were actually drawn up and designed specifically for the bailout package. You know, a funny thing about how Congress works is that there's this fight that's been going on for months over these renewable energy tax extenders, and all these goodies were already prepackaged as a way to try and convince reluctant House members to approve them.
But that begs the question, David, are there any members that you're aware of who voted yes on Monday but who now are thinking of voting no?
There are some fiscally conservative Democrats, the so-called Blue Dog Coalition, that's really angry that the tax provisions end up creating a net deficit of $107 billion in this. There were about $150 billion worth of tax breaks and other expenses, but only $43 billion of that is offset. So they're making noise, but Mike Ross, a congressman from Arkansas, who's one of the leaders of the Blue Dogs, sort of hinted that they may just have to step in line. He said, you know, one option is they oppose the bill. One option is they try to amend it, which, of course, will drag this out. And he said a third option is that we just may have to swallow this on behalf of the American economy. So it looks like there's a growing consensus, and there are some folks who are switching votes because there are really things they've been working on for years that are now included in this bill. Other folks who may have voted no on Monday, you know, because there was a lot of political noise and pressure, but you know, leaders seem to be confident that they've got the votes to pass it because they said they wouldn't bring it to the floor otherwise.
And it seems like everyone's got a little cover. I mean, the markets dropped yesterday, but it does seem as though there's not this sort of lockstep reaction chain that we saw on Monday. The markets are a little bit detached from this debate, and it does appear as though members have cover. They can make their own decisions about this, and the lowering of pressure may be an advantage to the administration. What do you think?
And sure, and there's also, there's also sort of a growing understanding of what exactly the administration and Congress are trying to do here. And with that is a sort of sobering reality that, you know what, this is not going to send the stock market soaring when it passes and have it at, you know, high elevated record levels all of a sudden. The more important measures to be checking are the credit markets and overnight lending rates, the interest rates that banks charge each other for short-term loans. And so I think that, you know, the market may have only a muted, you know, reaction on the upside, realizing that the economy is in really tough shape and the need for something like this is sort of alarming.
And certainly the banking sector is in tough shape. And as Congress debates, there are transformations and changes taking place there. David Herzenhorn, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
David Herzenhorn, New York Times reporter, joining us from Washington. And the debate is beginning in the House at this hour. Wells Fargo wagon is buying Wachovia. Wells Fargo Bank agreed to sell it to buy for $15.4 billion Wachovia Bank. It's technically not failed bank, but it is part of this acquisition that we're seeing as the House begins to debate financial
and
bailout.
And a bit of
bill.
A surprise, right? Because wasn't it Citigroup that was talking about potentially taking over
Wachovia? That was the
original. That was the beginning of the week, and here we are at the end. And again, more news with banks, new developments, as we've been seeing continually.
The Wells Fargo wagon, and, you know, it's like from the Broadway show, Paulson, Get Your Gun. Do you remember that show?
No,
actually maybe it was Annie, Get Your Gun. Yeah. Now we have headlines from Richard Hay.
And John, good morning to you. Wells Fargo, as you guys were mentioning, buying Wachovia for more than $15 billion in stock. This ends talks with Citigroup, which bid $2 billion for part of Wachovia that included FDIC help. I now believe we are going to go live to the House of Representatives, where they are debating.
Let the market sort itself out. They said that people must not be shielded from suffering the consequences of their own bad choices. They said that we should be considering alternative solutions based entirely on market principles. Madam Speaker, these are precisely my instincts as well, and I couldn't agree more. But I've ultimately concluded that this bill is a necessary evil. Why can't we let the market sort itself out this time? Because, Madam Speaker, the market didn't cause this mess. Let me say that again.
And that was Representative David Dreyer, Republican from California, debating at the House of Representatives this hour. Here on The Takeaway. Well, you know, you're not the only one upset about losses in investment. West Virginia, the state, is considering suing Merrill Lynch, AIG, and Lehman Brothers after the state lost nearly $23 million in its portfolio. Governor Joe Manchin has asked his staff to research possible legal action to recoup those losses. Also, another top headline, a spokesman says Iraq's presidential council has agreed on a law that paves the way for U.S.-backed provincial elections to be held by the end of January. And those are some of the top stories this morning.
Thank you, Richard. Market's about to open. Looks like a positive open or maybe flat. Thank you, Richard.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Well, speaking of responsibility, since this is public radio, we thought we'd spend the next few minutes making fun of Muslims and cracking jokes about terrorism.
Oh. That's Osama bin Laden. They can't find this guy, but he releases a DVD every month and a half. He's like the Muslim Tupac.
That's Preacher Moss, a comedian from Washington, D.C., and along with Azar Usman, Allah Made Me Funny, they formed a comedy tour based around the American Muslim Experience, and that's the title. It's also the title of an independent movie based on the tour, which opens for a one-week run in theaters. We're joined now by both of the founders of Allah Made Me Funny, Preacher Moss and Azar Usman. Both join us on the phone. Thanks, guys.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having me, man. I haven't been up this early since I was trying to catch a school bus about 20 years ago, so I appreciate you getting me up.
Yeah, thanks for sharing. We can certainly help you in many other ways. Explain what it feels like, and in some ways this movie is about comedy, but it's also like what it feels like to walk into a room of Americans and tell jokes about Muslims and to poke fun at the fear of terrorism. Azar?
Well, I would say it's a little bit of the underdog phenomenon. It feels a little bit like Sarah Palin walking into the vice presidential debate. You know you're kind of people are under expecting the show to sort of not deliver and not be very funny. And generally speaking, the feedback we've gotten is overwhelmingly positive. People find it to be a really funny show, and often surprisingly a lot funnier than they thought it'd be.
All right, let's listen to Azar, some of your act here. This is a clip from the comedy tour, and this is you talking about what happens in the media whenever there's a terrorist attack.
How is it that as soon as some international incident happens, the media has footage of the angry Muslim protesters? It's like they're paid actors or something, you know? And for some reason, have you noticed they always have American flags, and they're burning effigies of George Bush. Which to me means there is some very enterprising entrepreneur in the Muslim world who specializes in American flags and papier-mâché models of Western political leaders.
That's pretty funny stuff there, Azar. And that's not a laugh track. Those are real people laughing,
those
right?
Those are real people, man. It was a real delight. We recorded the film predominantly at one live show in Orange County last August. And, you know, we joke a lot about the fact that we travel all the time. And, you know, one thing I'll tell you, it's often very different for me telling jokes overseas than it is in America. It's a totally different vibe because I just came back from Europe, and it's totally different over there. Like, I walk down the street in America where I'm from, I get dirty looks for being a Muslim. So sometimes it's kind of nice to be hated just for being an American.
And you go to Europe, and they're, like, begging you, do you have any more Bush jokes? Any more Bush jokes? We really want more Bush jokes. Here's an example of Preacher Moss's act. I want to give people a sense of that. Preacher, this is something. Actually, I don't know exactly what this is, but let's listen.
It's cutting out of opportunities. This is why you don't see any Nation of Islam weathermen on TV. You don't want to see your weather delivered by Minister James 3X. Good morning, KTLA. Click. Assalamu alaikum, everybody. And welcome to your weather with me, Minister James 3X. Come on over to the chart. Bring the chart down, white man. If you look in L.A. County, the weather's going to be beautiful. 85 sunny, not a cloud in the sky. For the black man, rain all day.
That's a spin on the Al Roker image there, Preacher Moss. I love that.
Well, you know, it was interesting because a lot of people all of a sudden think that I'm in the Nation of Islam. which tells you how much people pay attention.
So, Preacher Moss, what was your hope in putting together and helping to develop this program and taking it not only across the United States, but through Europe, Africa, and Australia?
Well, I think, you know, there's two dominant themes. Like, when you look at the political scene, there's those people that like to have the last word, and then there's those people that like to have the last shot. I'm African-American. I'm from the original protest community, so we like to have the last shot. And what we like is the fact that we didn't take it from just our point of view, but we took it from an American point of view, which is inclusive of African-American Muslims, immigrant Muslims, and non-Muslims. You know, what we talk about is what we deal with in daily life. And I thought that would be the thing that, if anything, will allow us to have a sense of hope on a continuum, which goes far beyond just the guys on Allah Made Me Funny tour.
Well, certainly what's hopeful about this film is that it does re-engage the dialogue on some very touchy issues. Azar, describe for me how you go from making fun of yourself to actually poking fun at the audience's fears.
Well, I think that's what good comedy does. You know, the history of stand-up, in my view, has always been an art of protest. And stand-up has always been, good stand-up, in my view, has always been smart comedy. And smart comedy should make you laugh, but also think. And one thing that we pride ourselves on is, you know, all the comedians work clean. All the comedians do really smart, almost kind of heady material. But ultimately, you know, we put on a heck of a show where people walk away really having had a good, solid gut laugh. But on the drive home, they kind of find themselves thinking about what we talked about. And on the way home, they might have a revelation where they realize there was a lot more than just jokes going on. There was actually a lot of very important subject matter being dealt with.
Indeed, there is. Preacher Moss, D.C.-based comic, 20-year veteran comedy writer and performer, founder of Allah Made Me Funny, and Azar Usman, Chicago-based stand-up comic and one of the three members of the Allah Made Me Funny comedy tour. The movie about the tour opens today. And now, headlines from Richard Haig.
And John, it's 21 minutes before the top of the hour. The Labor Department says employers slashed payrolls by 159,000 in September, the most in more than 5 years. It's a worrying sign that the economy is heading toward a deep recession. The government's report also shows the nation's unemployment rate held steady at 6.1%. The debate was against Sarah Palin, but John McCain was Joe Biden's main target as last night's vice presidential debate in St. Louis was underway. Biden and McCain said McCain sided with the president on crucial issues, and that McCain is no maverick on the things that matter to people's lives. As for Palin, she cast Biden and Barack Obama as tax raisers who would risk defeat in the war on terror. Wachovia says it will be acquired by Wells Fargo in a $15.1 billion all-stock deal. The move wipes out Wachovia's previous plan to sell its banking operations to rival suitor Citigroup. The deal will be done without any government assistance. Members of the House right now are giving the financial bailout package another go as congressional leaders make last-ditch attempts to sway reluctant lawmakers. It's still unclear whether leaders will have enough support needed to pass the measure. And this is one of those stories that makes you scratch your head for a minute. A group of parents and religious leaders in upstate New York in Messina want yoga classes out of the public schools, saying the instruction violates boundaries between church and state. Two high school teachers began using yoga last year to help students relieve stress before exams, but those plans were halted after parents and others in the community complained that the students were being indoctrinated in Hindu rites.
Is that a yoga move, scratching your head?
Probably, yes.
You scratch your head like this.
That's good, John.
That's good. Is that good?
You're good at that.
Breathe deeply.
Yeah, that's right.
Very good. Thank you.
You need a mantra.
Yeah, mantra.
Oh,
there you go.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. And John, question. Have you ever had any Palin Syrah?
Oh, sure. It's a perky wine that really stands up in the glass with a kind of a ambiguous, almost incomprehensible bouquet that delivers personality in every sip.
So you liked it?
Yeah, it was good. It was good.
Well, Palin Syrah is a modestly popular organic Chilean wine that went for about $13 a bottle. And then came misfortune, or at least it appears to be misfortune, according to Chris Tavelli, the co-owner of Yield Wine Bar in San Francisco. Chris, you say that as soon as Alaska's governor, Sarah Palin, was named to the Republican ticket, your wine, Palin Syrah, it hit the skids.
Yes, it did. We actually started carrying the wine in July, about a month before she got the nomination. And then when she got the nomination, there was a lot of chatter at the bar about her, and some people just didn't want to order the wine.
They didn't want to order the wine because they're opposed there in San Francisco. How shocking. They're opposed to a Republican candidate, the vice presidential candidate?
Well, I think, yes, that's probably true, but also I think she was just all over the media for so long, people were just kind of saturated with her, so they just didn't really want to say the name.
So they took it off. They took it out on the wine.
Yeah, for a couple of weeks it got beat up, but now it's back to selling again.
It's back to selling again. How would you describe its body and taste?
Well, actually, the wine is quite good. It's an organic wine from Chile, and organic wines do really well for us. We focus on organic wines. It's full-bodied. It's spicy. It's got a lot of character.
And don't you think you folks in San Francisco, though, should really kind of lighten up, in reacting politically to a wine that has a name that sort of sounds like Sarah Palin?
Well, it's actually been a really good kind of talking point. It's been really good for people to kind of unwind a little bit about things that they take too seriously.
And you've also let them kind of describe what it is. Tell us some of the descriptions you've gotten.
Oh, boy. Those go on and on. So right now on the wine list, our descriptors for it are Madrone, white pepper, dry, full-bodied, people have inserted things like gunpowder, salmon, hints of northern exposure.
Moose hair,
yeah. Moose meat, smoked moose meat.
So how would you describe, what kind of drop-off was it? Like, how much of the Palin Sarah you were selling before Sarah Palin was nominated, and how much have you been selling in the last couple of weeks?
Well, it's gone back up in the last couple of weeks. It really hit the skids, right? Like you said, right after the nomination, pretty much from one of our bestsellers to one of our not-so-bestsellers. But now people are ordering it again. But the comments themselves are still there.
Very quickly, what's the lesson you've learned here?
The lesson I've learned? Well, I'm just happy people around the country are actually drinking organic wine from Chile. Because yeah. My importer tells me that he's sold out of the wine. People are calling from all over the country asking to buy it. So that's
well, there you go.
It's
Chris
like Tavelli,
like an action figure. Chris right. Tavelli, thank you this morning.
You're welcome.
Chris Tavelli is co-owner of Yield Wine Bar in San Francisco, telling us about Palin Sarah, a Chilean organic wine.
Perky with hints of moose.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, October 3rd, and we have some headlines for you from Richard Hake, who's sitting in for Femi Oke. Richard.
And Adora, good morning. It is 12 minutes before the top of the hour. Once called a major blow to al-Qaeda, now a federal appeals court has overturned the convictions of two men in a terrorism case, ruling that the men were deprived of fair trial. In Michigan, John McCain is pulling his ads off the air and his staff out of the state, responding to a recent drop in Michigan's polls. McCain is shifting resources to other swing states such as Ohio, Florida, and Wisconsin. A probe into Sarah Palin's past can go ahead as planned. According to an Alaska judge, state Republicans had tried to block the investigation. In question is Palin's role in the firing of her sister's ex-husband, an Alaska state trooper. Palin's husband and her staff have refused to appear under subpoena. Wells Fargo says it's acquiring Wachovia in an all-stock transaction worth about $15.1 billion. Wachovia investors will receive about one-fifth of a Wells Fargo share for every Wachovia share that they hold. And it is Friday, and we should have some fun here on The Takeaway.
Yes.
You know, The Simpsons.
Yes.
The Simpsons are airing an episode right before Election Day.
Jessica Simpson?
Not Jessica Simpson. Let's think Homer Simpson going into a voting booth.
Ooh, one of those electronic voting dealies.
One vote for McCain. Thank you.
No, I want to vote for Obama.
Two votes for McCain.
Come on, it's time for a change.
Three votes for McCain.
No, no, no.
Six votes for President McCain.
Hey, I only meant one of those votes for McCain. This machine is rigged.
And then at the end of the clip, Homer sucked into the voting machine.
That's good. Well, that would be a surprise in the voting booth. Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
But what surprised you about the debate last night? What'd you learn?
My name is Pedro from New York City. Doggone it, I learned a new word last night, Bosniaks.
Pedro's a little too smart for school here. He's referring to Joe Biden, who used the word Bosniaks in the debate last night, which caused a little confusion about that word. Here's Cokie Roberts on Charlie Rose.
They talked about the Bosniaks.
The Bosniaks.
Bosniaks.
Yes.
And there was McKiernan versus McClellan.
And if she had said Bosniak, everybody would be making a big deal of it.
Yeah, making a big deal of it. She knows it's a word. Bosniak is actually a word. According to the CIA fact book, Bosniak has replaced Muslim as an ethnic term, in part to avoid confusion with the religious term Muslim. Bosniak, it's actually a word. So joining us now on all things political, whether it's linguistic or otherwise, is New York Times political reporters Jeff Zeleny and Elizabeth Buemiller. This week, while the nation focused its attention on the big Wall Street bailout and the vice presidential debate, there has been a campaign going on between John McCain and Barack Obama. There were some very interesting moments this week. Jeff Zeleny and Elizabeth Mueller, what have we missed in the coverage of everything else that's going on this week? Jeff, let's start with you.
Well, I think one of the things we've missed is exactly what's been happening on the ground. For the last week, a lot of voter registration deadlines have been coming up. So Democrats believe, and the Obama campaign believes, that it has been really increasing its voter registration advantage. It's one of the reasons that John McCain is pulling out of Michigan.
Really?
Because Democrats have really increased their edge there. So as things have been going on in Washington, as John McCain sort of snubbed Senator Obama on the Senate floor a couple days ago, real things have been happening on the ground. But the McCain campaign has been increasing their advantage in some red states as well. So this ballgame is not over.
Elizabeth, what was this snub? I totally missed that this week.
Well, the snub was when both Senator McCain and Senator Obama went back to Washington to vote in the Senate for the bailout bill, which they're now calling a rescue bill, the economic package. And Senator Obama, Jeff was there actually. I was not, but Senator Obama reached out his hand to greet McCain. He seemed to seek him out, and McCain very coolly grabbed the hand, but kind of turned aside and moved on. It really was kind of striking. And that is the snub. And I think the other thing that people have been missing, although it would be hard to miss, is that there's a sense among Republicans that the McCain campaign is in trouble. Now that can change. You know, we've seen this election where everything has changed on a dime, and McCain was left for dead. You know, during the primaries, let's not forget. But it's getting very close to the election. There's a sense that things are really going badly for the McCain campaign, and there's a question about whether he can salvage it.
Well, focusing on that snub for a minute, it's just mm-hmm. one of a number of examples this week where McCain has had an
right.
opportunity to be candid and really sounded nasty.
Well, what you're referring to most, I suspect, is his interview with the Des Moines Register editorial board. First of all, there were people in the party who questioned why he was in Iowa to begin with, because it's not a state he's going to expect it to do especially well. And what was interesting about that interview is that McCain, a number of times, was sort of snappy, testy. There was one moment he was kind of sarcastic with a member of the editorial board. He also said at one point, well, maybe people were questioning about his choice of Sarah Palin, and he said something about, well, maybe that's people at Georgetown cocktail parties believe that. By the way, you know, McCain has been to a number of Georgetown dinner
right.
parties himself. So.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, let's listen to McCain on the stump. Here he mm-hmm. is in Denver talking about cleaning up Wall Street in Washington.
It's going to take a new broom, my friends. It's going to take somebody in there to drain the swamp, and I will clean it out, and I will fix it, and I'll make sure we never have this challenge again.
Jeff Zeleny, what's the focus on Colorado?
Well, the focus on Colorado is this has been a Republican state, at least for the last two presidential campaigns. President Clinton did a win Colorado with the help of Ross Perot. But the focus on Colorado now is a changing dynamic throughout the West. Democrats believe that with the growth of Hispanic voters and other moderates and people moving into the Denver suburbs and the city of Denver, that Democrats have a real chance in winning Colorado. You can just tell what's going on mm-hmm. by the travel schedules of the candidates. I've been traveling with Senator Obama since the Democratic convention. He's been back to Colorado three times.
And Colorado, just to interrupt you there, Jeff, isn't that also one of the states that has early voting and the begun voting? And how does that play into the strategies, really, of both campaigns?
It is one of the states that has early voting. I don't believe it's started yet. I believe it starts in a week or so. But the early voting is a big strategy for both sides, but particularly for the Democrats, because if Democrats are going to win this election, if Senator Obama's strategy is going to work, they are going to have to get a lot of new voters, people who have not voted before, to the polls. So the early voting allows a lot of text messaging and phone calling and really reminding people who are not necessarily used to voting to vote. But Colorado, New Mexico, Nevada, these states out west are really some of the new battlegrounds in this year's campaign.
Well, let's listen to Obama on the stump kind of declaring victory in my hometown of Grand Rapids, Michigan here.
This is the philosophy he's embraced during his 26 years in Washington. Over the past few days, he's talked a lot about getting tough on Wall Street, but over the past few decades, he's fought against the very rules of the world that could have stopped this mess.
Elizabeth, before we go, I mean, it seems like this message of what McCain did in his 26 years in the Senate is starting to get some traction.
Sure, and I think, but I just wanted to say Michigan's a really interesting case because it's a pretty stunning development that McCain is pulling out, and the campaign made the decision that they were spending way. Detroit is very expensive. It was to campaign in to have advertising in, and McCain did not do it. He did lost the primary to Mitt Romney, and you know he went to Michigan and carried the message of, you know, these jobs are not coming back, they're not coming back, and maybe that's true, but nobody liked to hear it,
right.
And that was the end of Michigan.
And it's stuck even through the general election.
Sure.
Elizabeth and Jeff, we're going to have to go, but thanks so much.
Thank you.
New York Times political reporters Jeff Zeleny and Elizabeth Buhmiller are talking about some fascinating details that you might have missed this week on the campaign.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. And we have more. Election Day is less than 5 weeks away. Of course, here at The Takeaway, we're always on. And for your election coverage, you can go to vote2008.thetakeaway.org.
And we've been hearing from you all morning, you Insta pundits out there, about your reaction to the debate last night.
Frank in Pleasantville, my absolute favorite part was the end of the debate when everybody came up on stage and was friendly and talking to each other like people, because after a while the politics is just I'm at my limit here after 2 years of it. It was nice to see them all acting as people.
And before he was acting like a real person, what do you think was going on in Joe Biden's mind during the debate?
Don't take the bait, don't bite back, don't start a fight, be calm.
That's actually not Joe Biden. That's Alaskan journalist Larry Persily.
Who lives in his brain. He lives in his brain. Persily lives in Biden's
brain. No, I thought he had ESP, though, really.
Right. That was great, though. If you missed any of our Wall Street Rescue Plan coverage, you can catch up with us on iTunes. And there's a link to our friend feed page and our video podcast on our homepage, thetakeaway.org. Is it Friday already? Should we do a show on Saturday?
I think Friday's good. Right. Monday through Friday, I think, is really perfect, actually.
I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.